This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin, and here's what's coming up.
We are sleeping on bare floors. We hadn't any food to eat. They were giving us plastics to defecate in the plastics, and later they tell us to go and throw either in the bush or in the river. Even to urinate, we are given containers. We urinate on the containers, and the worst part of it is that we are being beaten with a cutlass.
That was Mildred Awemo, a 26-year-old former student who was among 9 hostages freed by Anglophone separatists after 2 months in captivity in Cameroon. Cameroon's military has freed 9 civilians who say they were held hostage by Anglophone separatists for close to 2 months. Some of the freed hostages say the rebels tortured them, chopping off their ears and fingers. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the town of Bamenda in northwestern Cameroon.
Dozens of people on Monday visited the military camp in the English-speaking town of Bamenda. The visitors said they wanted to find out if their relatives were among the hostages freed by Cameroon's army on Saturday. The military said the 9 former hostages are all males between 16 and 27 years old. 24-year-old Peter Ate says he was abducted from the village of Pinyin by armed men on March 23. He says separatists accused him of collaborating with the military when he refused to join their cause. Ate says while in captivity, he endured the worst moments of his life.
We are sleeping on bare floors. We hadn't any food to eat. They were giving us plastics to defecate in the plastics, and later they tell us to go and throw either in the bush or in the river. Even to urinate, we are given containers. We urinate on the containers, and the worst part of it is that we are being beaten with a cutlass.
Ate said 6 of his fingers were chopped off with a machete when he made a failed attempt to escape. Separatists have said on social media that the kidnappers were criminals, not their fighters, a claim the military has rejected. All the freed hostages looked tired, hungry, and unkempt. 2 had parts of their ears chopped off. 2 of the former hostages said they spent 2 months in captivity and that 7 captives were freed after their families paid ransom. Ate said 3 other captives who agreed to join the fighters were not tortured. The military said Saturday's operation was designed to free kidnapped victims in the northwestern towns of Pinyin, Santa Anakum. It said 9 hostages were freed and 2 fighters killed, while at least 20 armed men escaped and are hiding in the bush. Mildred Awemo is a 26-year-old former student at Pinyin. She says she saw the corpses of 2 civilians after the military raid. She says the troops arrested many civilians and tortured 4 who were rushed to a hospital in Pinyin by villagers.
When the military attack a village, we don't distinguish between the fighters and the civilians. It just torments everybody. We want to be free, but we need to know who are the civilians because they are trained to know the civilians and also the fighters. The military is trained to fight those who are holding guns and not the civilians who are harmless.
Nka Valet is commander of troops fighting separatists in the northwest region. He denies any wrongdoing by his troops.
Dans les jours qui suivent, vous allez... On va continuer de nettoyer.
Nka says his troops will intensify attacks to clean the English-speaking northwestern town of Bamenda and its environs of fighters who are hiding in the community and creating disorder. He says the duty of the military is to ensure that total peace and serenity returns. He says it is imperative for the population to collaborate with the troops by denouncing suspected fighters hiding in the midst of civilians. Separatists have been fighting since 2017 to carve out an independent English-speaking nation from the rest of the French-speaking Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bamenda. Cameroon.
At least 11 people were killed and 98 others injured yesterday in a train derailment in the Egyptian Delta city of Touk, north of the capital Cairo. A health ministry statement says 60 ambulances ferried victims to three public hospitals. The Ministry of Transportation says four train cars derailed along a journey from Cairo to the Delta city of Mansoura. Security sources said the driver and other rail officials were detained for questioning. President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi says he is setting up a commission to investigate the causes of the crash. Egyptian rail disasters are generally attributed to poor infrastructure and maintenance. This is the second major derailment in less than a month. Two trains collided March 26th in the southern province of Sohag, killing at least 32 people and wounding 108 others. The Rwandan government published a report today that concludes that the French government bears, quote, significant, end quote, responsibility for, quote, enabling a foreseeable genocide, end quote, before and during the horror in which an estimated 800,000 people were slaughtered in 1994. The 600-page report says France, quote, did nothing to stop, end quote, the massacres, then tried to cover up its role and even offered protection to some perpetrators. The formal presentation of the report was made public to Rwanda's cabinet. Last month, France also published its own report that concludes its government had been, quote, blind, end quote, to genocide preparations, but clears it of complicity in the genocide. The United Nations Refugee Agency is calling for restoration of peace in the Democratic Republic of Congo's Greater Kasai region as renewed violence threatens another mass movement of people. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Local authorities estimate 21,000 people have fled their homes since March 28th. That is when land disputes between Luba and Kuba ethnic groups triggered renewed clashes in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, killing at least 13 people and injuring many more. This resurgence of violence follows a relatively long period of calm. Baba Baluch, spokesman for the UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency, says UN officials fear this new outbreak could lead to another large-scale displacement if it is not quickly addressed.
And humanitarian organizations, we are calling for a renewed focus on restoring peace and diffusing tensions in Kasai to prevent another wave of mass displacement in the country. So there has to be efforts in terms of negotiations and also bringing those two communities together, but also restoring law and order in the Greater Kasai region as well.
Intercommunal violence in 2017 displaced 1.4 million people inside the DRC and forced 35,000 refugees to flee to neighboring Angola. Sporadic outbursts of violence have occurred since then. Tensions between the two ethnic groups over mineral and timber resources have been rising since August and have displaced some 40,000 people. As in the past, most of those fleeing the current crisis are women and children. The UNHCR says most have fled without any belongings and that people need shelter, food, and medical care. The agency is providing emergency supplies, including plastic tarpaulins for shelter, mosquito nets, jerry cans, and kitchen sets, but says it needs more money for the work in the region. It has received just 12% of the $205 million it says it needs for DRC humanitarian operations this year. Conflict and violence in the DRC have displaced 5.5 million people, the largest internally displaced population in Africa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Gunmen on motorcycles attacked a village near Niger's troubled border with Mali and Burkina Faso, killing 19 mourners who were attending a funeral. The attack took place Saturday evening in Gagoro village in Niger's Tillaberi region, which has come under repeated attacks by suspected Islamic militants since January, mostly along shared borders with Mali and Burkina Faso. Last month, 137 people were slaughtered in the Tawa region, days after another group of 58 were killed by suspected militants in another Tillaberi region. The United States Embassy in Chad has ordered its non-essential staff to leave the African country as rebels approached the capital yesterday. This came as early election results showed President Idriss Deby on course to extend his three-decade rule. Deby, who seized power in 1990 at the head of an arms rebellion, is a staunch ally of France and the U.S. in the fights against Islamist militants in the Sahel region. The Chadian military said it had halted the rebel advance from neighboring Libya, but the rebel group said it was pressing ahead. Nigerian authorities are stepping up efforts to vaccinate more people against COVID-19 after a slow rollout blamed on misinformation. Authorities aim to vaccinate over 80 million Nigerians by year's end, but are running far behind schedule. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
This Abuja Vaccination Center, which opened March 16, 1 week after Nigeria's official vaccine rollout, vaccinates between 50 and 100 people daily. It is one of many vaccination locations in the Nigerian capital. Abuja resident Olu Agumbiade visited the center to get his first shot and says receiving the vaccine makes him feel safer.
So I can venture out into the world with a form of protection. I know that doesn't mean I still can't contract COVID, but at least I have antibodies that can help me fight it.
Nigeria received about 4 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine early last month. Authorities say they will vaccine around 80 million people by the end of the year, but so far, only about 1 million have received shots. Although authorities say more Nigerians are now getting vaccinated, Abuja Primary Health Care Board Executive Secretary Ndeyo Aiwat says vaccine hesitancy and misinformation about the coronavirus are to blame for the low numbers.
It's a very big problem because now, start from the beginning, how many people even that we had the pandemic here? And now you are bringing vaccines that it is for what you do not even believe at the first instance. We have a lot of work to do.
As workaround, authorities are trying to increase vaccine awareness in communities, villages, and marketplaces. Despite this, though, citizens like Richard Uka insist they will not get the vaccine.
To be sincere, I don't think that this is necessary. To me, it's not necessary. And I believe that in Nigeria, nothing works. How do you think that vaccine works? Or how do we know that it works?
Nigeria needs to vaccinate about 150 million citizens by next year to attain herd immunity. Aiwat, though, says getting adequate doses of vaccines may prove difficult.
Looking at the pandemic situation in Europe, India, and the USA and the UK. Some of them are even experiencing the third and fourth phases spikes now. And India, that was giving us, is also having spikes now. So many of the doses they have will be consumed there.
Very few African countries are able to manufacture the coronavirus vaccines, creating heavy dependence on foreign manufacturers. The World Health Organization says the continent has so far received less than 2% of the global 690 million doses of the coronavirus vaccines. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And the Malawi government has given refugees and asylum seekers who have left the country's only refugee camp, Dzaleka, 2 weeks to return to the camp or face eviction for those who have settled elsewhere and are operating businesses outside the camp. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
A Burundian refugee, Jean Nduimana, not her real name, left the Dzaleka refugee camp 5 years ago to start a shop in the Njeu district where she sells handmade jewels. She says the decision followed pressure from her Malawian customers who would travel long distances to the refugee camp to buy baskets, bags, necklaces, and jewelry from her. She says almost 100% of my customers were Malawians, so customers asked me to open a shop in their area because there was no shop like mine in there. Nduimana, a single mother of 3 children, says the decision to return to the refugee camp would negatively affect her livelihood and would not be good for those who rely on her shop. Nduimana is among 2,000 refugees who have settled elsewhere and are operating businesses in various parts of Malawi. Richard Chimwendubanda is the Minister of Homeland Security. He told a press conference Friday That is against the government's encampment policy, which prohibits refugees from operating business outside a refugee camp. He also said by living outside the camp, the refugees threaten national security.
We have given them notifications to ask them to return to the camp according to the law. And we are working hand in hand with all departments, including UNHCR, just to make sure that there's a peaceful transition and that they understand what is happening.
Rafael Ndabaga is a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo and director for the Volunteer Social Workers Organization at the Dzaleka refugee camp. He says the refugees cannot object to the government's decision, but he is worried about overcrowding at the already congested refugee camp.
At first, Dzaleka was a place of only 10 to 15,000 people. But currently, as we are talking, Dzaleka accommodates more than 48,000 people. It is already congested. So when bringing those people back again, it's more like congesting the camp in another aspect.
The government decision follows complaints from local business people against the stiff competition from the foreign nationals. They say attract more customers by offering lower prices. Michael Kayiata is the executive director for Center for Human Rights and Rehabilitation. He says the government decision is likely to trigger violence against the foreigners.
And we have seen before that there have been conflicts, you know, between local communities and refugees, especially from Burundi, who are doing business in the city. So this will embolden them to think, okay, now this is the time to get rid of, you know, our business competitors.
Kayata has asked the government to rescind the decision because he says there is no proof the refugees living outside the camp are posing a threat to national security.
We think the government should ratify the, you know, refugee protocol so that the refugees in Malawi should be able to work, seek employment as in other countries. Because currently the law in Malawi, you know, bars refugees from working.
The spokesperson for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees in Malawi, Lumbani Nsisia, says the agency has no immediate comment on the matter. Lamik Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
A pall of smoke hangs over Cape Town, South Africa today as a fire spread after destroying buildings at the prestigious University of Cape Town on the slopes of Table Mountain. As Vicky Stark reports, arson is suspected.
J.P. Smith, the safety and security member of Cape Town's mayoral committee, says residents spotted three men setting fires on the mountain, which started at about 10 a.m. yesterday. A search led to the arrest of one suspect who is believed to be a vagrant. Smith says he confessed to starting the first fire that led to the destruction of university buildings.
The city can confirm that one suspect in his 30s was taken into custody last night in the vicinity of Devil's Peak. He was spotted by a resident who tracked him down with the help of his sons and the family's dogs.
The fire also destroyed the historic Mostert's Mill and the restaurant at Rhodes Memorial, as well as several thatched roof properties.
All efforts remain focused on active firefighting for the moment, although the fire is hard to reach in places. For the moment, there are precautionary evacuations taking place.
17 schools have been evacuated, as well as residents in several suburbs bordering the mountain. Yesterday, this young science student from the University of Cape Town had to flee her residence. I asked her if she left things behind.
I did. I feel fine. I'm safe. That's all that matters, really.
This young drama student describes watching the fire progress.
We knew that the fire was coming down the mountain and was reaching UCT, and we knew, okay, it was now behind upper campus, and then it was on middle campus, and then you found a full hall was on fire, and then you saw that the African Studies Library was on fire, which is insane because of the special books that they're holding there.
Many have lamented the loss of the African Studies Library that houses rare and irreplaceable works by indigenous people. The university hadn't confirmed exactly what has been lost. The university's Elijah Moholola.
In terms of damage to property, UCT is at this stage not able to confirm the extent of the damage to property, as well as the number of buildings affected, or even identifying what these buildings are. Once an assessment has been made, we will be able to share these details at a later stage.
Due to strong 45-kilometer-an-hour winds, the choppers that were initially used to waterbomb the fire and spot flare-ups have been grounded. Officials are using a Helix ISR system camera rigged to a two-seater glider plane that is flying over the ocean to take photographs of the area to help guide firefighters. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
Officials in Zimbabwe and Zambia say preliminary work on the Batoka Gorge Energy Project has been put on hold because of funding problems and pandemic restrictions. In Zimbabwe, journalist Eddie Gondo gives us more on the story.
The Zambezi River Authority, ZRA, recently said work on the US $4.6 billion hydropower plant has been suspended for several months because of the coronavirus pandemic and a lack of funds. Economic analysts think the project may take longer than originally planned because of funding constraints. The ZRA represents Zimbabwe and Zambia and manages the Kariba Dam Complex and Zambezi River, which borders and spans the two countries. Construction on the hydropower project was to have started last year. Once completed, the dam is expected to produce 2,400 megawatts to be equally divided between Zambia and Zimbabwe. The ZRIA now says construction will commence in late 2022. General Electric and Power Corporation of China won the bid to build the plant on the Zambezi River in 2019, beating out competitors from Italy and China. Economic analyst Reggie Shoko says raising money for capital projects in Zimbabwe is handicapped by several challenges, among them the country's reputation for economic policy inconsistency.
Given the perception that it is globally and even regionally to some extent, the sanctions on themselves are a big hindrance. They give a tag to a destination that a lot of things are not in order. The hyperinflationary environment that we've experienced as a country is also a big challenge. We normally, as a country or a destination like ours, attract investors that need quick returns. Hence the challenge of getting money for projects like energy into the country.
Shoko says that COVID-19 is a technical excuse and that the real issue is the risk factor for investors as far as both Zambia and Zimbabwe are concerned. Zambian analyst Mambo Hamawundu concurs.
We have borrowed quite heavily externally, and the cost of borrowing will really be steep on us because of the reputation that we have on the market.
Hamawundu says the Batoka project, which was first considered in 1992, also has been delayed by a number of issues, including haggling over colonial era debts and surrounding community concerns.
And I would like to believe that an environmental impact assessment has been done, and all these issues have been really dealt with. I think there were issues around the preservation of heritage site in Livingstone that we should, as a country, monitor and ensure that all these challenges that were identified have been addressed or solutions have been indicated. We do need to preserve the heritage site. It attracts a lot of tourists. We need that stream of income as a country. And it's also important that the community around the area in which the project is taking place feel part and parcel of it.
The Batoka power plant is expected to take 6 years to finish, although electricity generation will start in the third year. It will consist of a 175-meter-high dam wall and two 1,200-megawatt power plants in each country, alongside new settlements. The spokesperson for the Zambezi Electricity Supply Company, Henry Kapata, says his country is pursuing a multi-pronged approach to generating power in the country.
Another concept that we've adopted is what we call generation mix. And this is basically where we have partnered with several companies in putting up solar plants. One of the partners, obviously, is Power China, where we should be able to put about 300 megawatts of solar in these areas that are very prone to drought, provinces that are prone to drought. So we'll be injecting about 300 megawatts into the national grid.
Economic analysts say that the two countries have grappled with energy deficits, which hamper economic development. They say natural disasters such as droughts, obsolete equipment, and mismanagement contribute to power shortages. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Victoria Falls, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. For all latest developments on the continents, 24 hours a day, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.